I like doing that. Good evening and welcome to our very special meeting here at the Commonwealth of Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook, Twitter, and your YouTube channel. My name is David Campos, and I have the honor of serving on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. And today, it is my pleasure to be the moderator for this very important panel. And of course, you have seen our incredible guest, Bernie Sanders, and I'm just going to do a very brief introduction, though I think that in this crowd, he doesn't need an introduction. He is a United States Senator from the beautiful, amazing state of Vermont. He's an independent in every sense of the word. This is his second term in the United States Senate following a 16-year stint in the U.S. House of Representatives, which actually makes him the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history. Throughout his career, he has used his voice to defend the interests of working families, of the middle class, the elderly, children, and the poor. He is very concerned about the growing income and wealth gap in the United States and speaks about the excess of corporate America. Senator Sanders played a key role in making sure the Affordable Care Act was actually signed into law. He's a ranking member. Yes. He's the ranking member of the Senate Budget Committee and serves as chairman of the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs. He also serves on the Environment and Energy Committees, where he has championed energy efficiency and sustainable energy. And as a member of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, he has fought for greater access to affordable health care, and improved education programs for our kids. We are truly grateful that he's here. And as I was noting to him, that his talk about inequality is very timely in San Francisco because San Francisco right now stands as the city that has the fastest growing inequality in the United States. And so with that, I give you Senator Sanders.
David, thank you very much for moderating, and let me thank all of you very much for being here this evening. And let me thank the Commonwealth Club for doing here in San Francisco what should be done all over this country. As all of you know, we have very serious problems in our country, and in my view, the most serious of the serious problems is we do not seriously discuss our serious problems. And that is what the Commonwealth does. They invite deep people here from different points of view and have serious discussion, and that's a very important thing to be done. Let me start off by saying that I think we are in a pivotal moment in American history where we are facing more crises today than our country has faced since the Great Depression of the 1930s. And if you throw in the planetary crisis of climate change, it is arguable that this moment is even more frightening and more severe. As part of the crises that we face, I think there is growing disillusionment on the part of the American people with the establishment in general. And that is the corporate establishment, which has shown itself in recent years time and time again to care only about their own profits, about their own needs, and not about the American people. There is an organization called the Business Roundtable, which constitutes leadership of many major corporations and Wall Street firms. They recently came to the Congress, and what they said is, we who are all multi-millionaires, get when we retire about $1 million a year in retirement benefits from our companies, we want you to make massive cuts in Social Security, massive cuts in Medicare, and by the way, give the wealthiest people and the largest corporations even more in tax breaks. When you talk about what corporate America is doing, we needn't get into a long discussion about the greed and recklessness and illegal behavior on Wall Street, which drove this country into the worst recession since the Great Depression. Every place I go, just this afternoon somebody asked me, and they said, how does it happen that when the people on Wall Street committed these terrible crimes, which resulted in millions of people losing their jobs, losing their homes, losing their life savings, how come these guys didn't end up in jail? And the answer is that not only are these big banks too big to fail, their CEOs are too big to jail. And that's an issue that we have got to address. Second of all, in terms of the political establishment in this country, I think most people understand that you have one party, the Republican Party, which over the last 40 years has moved from a center-right party. I know it's hard to believe Dwight David Eisenhower was a Republican. It's true. And he's a guy who built the largest infrastructural improvement program in history up to his time, the interstate highway system, a man who proudly defended raising the minimum wage, a man who said loudly that anybody who talks about cutting Social Security is, you know, out of their minds. Today, somebody like Dwight David Eisenhower could not walk in to a Republican organization in America. His politics would make him a fringe member of the organization. And what you have is not only a Republican Party moving very far to the right, what you also have is a Democratic Party, which used to be under FDR, under Harry Truman, essentially the party of the American working class, a party that had the courage to stand up to big money. And let's not forget, 1936, when FDR ran for election, re-election, he said what he called the economic royalist, what we would call the billionaire class today. He said, they hate my guts, and I welcome their hatred. You're hearing many Democrats talking about that anymore? Not so many. Okay. And then you got a media establishment, and one of the problems that we have in America is as media becomes more concentrated, what you see, in my line of work, I see it very, very clearly, that politics, which should be a serious debate about real problems and a serious debate about real solutions, has become, for much of media, not all, basically a game show type of activity or a game of survivors. So what we, instead of writing about what people think and the solutions that they are proposing, what we hear is about polls and the amount of money that people raise and whether somebody said something really dumb or all of the gossip of who is going to win or not win, rather than allowing the American people to engage in serious discussion. Well, serious discussion is what I hope we'll have tonight. So let me start off by talking about what's going on economically in this country. And the bottom line, after all is said and done, that the American middle class for the last 40 years has been disappearing. That's the simple reality. Real unemployment today is not the official 5.5% you read in the papers. If you count those people who have given up looking for work or working part-time when they want to work full-time, real unemployment is 11%. Youth unemployment. Anyone hear any discussion about youth unemployment? 17%. African youth unemployment, much higher than that. So we have a major unemployment crisis in this country. Millions of American workers are today working longer hours for lower wages. 45 million Americans are now living in poverty, almost more than in any time in the modern history of our country. The United States of America has, by far, the highest rate of childhood poverty of any major country on earth, and that number is somewhere around 18%. Today, despite the modest successes of the Affordable Care Act, we still have 35 million Americans without any health insurance, and we have many others, including, I'm sure, people in this room, who are underinsured with high premiums and high deductibles. The United States shamefully remains the only country, major country on earth, that does not guarantee people health care as a right, something which we should end. That is why I support That is why I support a Medicare for All single-payer program. Now, when you look out all over America, you see a lot of very angry people. And let me very briefly tell you why they are angry. Everybody in this room knows that there has been an explosion in technology and a huge increase in worker productivity, correct? Everybody knows that. One would think that in any type of rational economy, if I gave you a tool which made you 50% more productive, one of two things happens. Either your salary, your income goes up significantly, or else you work fewer hours. But obviously in the economy today, despite the huge increase in productivity, neither of those realities are happening. The truth is that many people are working longer hours for lower wages. I remember when I was in college, they used to give a course when robotics was really beginning, you know, they talk about automation in factories. They gave a course about what Americans would do with all of the leisure time they had. Remember that? Hey, if your work week was reduced to 20 hours a week, what would you do? They don't teach that course anymore. The course they now teach is how couples can stay together and raise healthy kids with all of the stress that they are dealing with. I'll never forget, I was outside a grocery store in Burlington, Vermont. And a woman came up to me and she said, you know, Bernie, we have one kid, we'd like to have more kids, but I'm working 50 hours a week, I'm doing three jobs, my husband is doing two jobs, and we don't think we can be the parents we want to be. And that's the story all over this country. Do you remember at the beginning of the century, those pictures in the textbooks we used to read in school where workers were holding up signs that says, we want a 40-hour week, you remember that? We still don't have a 40-hour week. In my state, it is honestly, and I doubt that it's any different here, but in Vermont, you have a whole lot of people who are trying to cobble together an income working not one job, but two jobs, three jobs, trying to get some health insurance and trying to pay the bills. So when you talk about why people are angry, the reason is they know they're more productive, and yet they can't understand why it is that they're forced to work longer hours and make lower wages and have lower income. Since 1999, the median middle-class family, that family right in the middle of our economy, has seen its income go down by almost $5,000, adjusting for inflation. That family earned almost $500 less last year than it did 26 years ago. You got a great global economy, which is going to create all kinds of wonderful jobs. You have all of this technology, all of the computers, all of the robotics. And that median family income is making $500 less in inflation accounted for dollars than it made in 1989. You want to know why all these Tea Party guys on TV are really angry? Today, male workers made $783 less last year than they did 42 years ago. Female workers, women workers, earned $1,300 less last year than they did in 2007. So we got to throw that issue right on the table. Why? What happened? Has a national catastrophe occurred in America? Our productive capabilities were destroyed. We were bombed. What happened? Why is it that with all of that technology out there, life is not getting better for the vast majority of the people, but in fact is becoming harder. Since 2005, the median family income has seen its wealth go down by more than 36%. Truth is, you go all over this country, and I have been all over this country, you're seeing people living under incredible stress. Half the people in this country have less than $10,000 in savings. You know what that means? That means they were an automobile accident, a divorce, a serious illness away from financial disaster. That's why people are nervous. That's why people are stressed out. Because they are scared to death, not only for their own lives, not only what happens to them when they get old, they're worried about what kind of life their kids will have. Today, 5.5 million kids in this country, 5.5 million young people who either dropped out of high school, and our dropout rate is far, far too high, or graduated high school. You know what they're doing, 5.5 million kids? They're doing nothing. They're hanging out on street corners in Burlington, Vermont, and in San Francisco, California, and too many of them getting into self-destructive activities, getting into drugs, and ending up in jail. Maybe, just maybe, we as a nation might want to invest in education for these kids, in job training, rather than in jails for these kids. When we talk about the decline of the middle class, what we have got to understand is that since 2001, this country has lost 60,000 factories. 60,000 factories. For the young people in the audience, let me tell you something you don't know. There was once a time when you could actually go into a department store and buy products made in the United States of America. I'm not lying. It's true. Not just China or Vietnam, but the United States of America. Now, why have we lost that manufacturing capability? There are a number of reasons. But one of the key reasons are disastrous trade policies like NAFTA, CAFTA, permanent normal relations with China. Corporate America pushed that on the Congress, on Democratic presidents, on Republican presidents, so that they can say to American workers, you know what, if you don't take cuts in your pay, take cuts in your health care, we're moving to China, and many of them have. And they have moved to China and other countries not because they were losing money in America, simply because they can make even more money in low-wage countries. And in my view, very strongly, we have got to rethink our trade policies. We have got to start demanding that corporate America invest in the United States of America, create jobs here rather than in China and Vietnam and other countries. When we talk about what's happening in this country, there was once a time, 30 years ago, where the United States led the world in terms of the percentage of our people who had college degrees. Today we are in 12th place. 40, 50 years ago, how much did it cost to go to the great University of California, one of the great public universities in America? How much did it cost? Zero. City University of New York, zero. State colleges all over America, free tuition. And yet today, for a whole lot of working class families, the dream of sending their kids to college is tragically disappearing. And hundreds of thousands of young people are giving up that dream because they're scared to death of coming out of school deeply in debt in an unstable economy. And then you have others who do go to college or graduate school who end up deeply, deeply in debt. Talked to a woman in Burlington, Vermont last year. Her crime was that she went to medical school and wanted to practice primary care for low-income people, exactly what we need in this country. You know what her debt was? $300,000. That's what's going on. What do we have to do? Well, among other things, I will be introducing legislation to make tuition free in every public college and public university in America. Some people say, well, we can't afford it. It's an expensive proposition. It is. Well, if we can afford to spend $38 billion more on the military, we can afford to provide tuition-free education to our young people. 50 years ago, in this great country, 50 years ago, we had an infrastructure, roads, bridges, water systems, airports, rail, that was the envy of the entire world. Today, we're way, way down compared to other countries. China has high-speed rail, and congratulations for California for moving forward in that direction. But while other countries have advanced, we have fallen behind. The American Society of Civil Engineers tells us we need to spend $3.6 trillion to bring our infrastructure up to par. I have introduced legislation with Senator Mikulski, Barbara Mikulski of Maryland, which will invest $1 trillion in the next 5 years. And you know what we do? We go a long way to rebuilding our infrastructure, and we create and save 13 million decent-paying jobs. I think that's a step forward. Now, David introduced me by saying that I talk about income and wealth inequality a lot, and I do. And I sometimes bore people to death My wife says I throw out too many facts. She's probably right, but I am going to bore you for a moment because it's important that you understand the degree of what is going on in America today. And I think the dilemma is, the tragedy is that while people are so financially stressed, ordinary people, they're looking around and they're seeing the richest people in this country and the largest corporations becoming much wealthier and more profitable. So it's not just that the middle class is disappearing. What it is that we are living in a country with a grotesque and obscene level of income and wealth inequality. Today, the top 1% owns 41.8% of the financial wealth of America. The bottom 60% owns less than 2%. Got it? In fact, listen to this, the top 0.1% owns almost as much wealth as the bottom 90%. Today, one family, the Walton family of Walmart, owns more wealth than the bottom 40% of the American people. There was a fact that just came out a couple of weeks ago from the communist publication called Forbes. And we all know Stephen Forbes to be a raving commie type. But this is what the statistic showed. I want you just to appreciate this statistic and the enormity of it. In the last two years, between 2013 and 2015, the wealthiest 14 people, not 1,400, not 14,000, 14 people, that is Gates, and that is Buffett, and that is the Koch brothers and those guys, 14 people saw their wealth increase by $157 billion in 2 years. Now, $157 billion, that's their increase in wealth. That is more wealth than is owned by the bottom 40% of the American people. That's 130 million people. So the level, what we're looking at now, and I say this to you not to be overly dramatic, but if you look at where we are economically, we are moving toward an oligarchic form of society where a handful of billionaires have unbelievable power and unbelievable wealth within the context of the American economy. And what is doubly dangerous about that situation is not only the morality of the issue. Are we comfortable as a people when we have the highest level of childhood poverty of any major country at the same time as we're seeing a proliferation of millionaires and billionaires? It is also a political issue, because as a result of the disastrous Citizens United decision, what do you think these billionaires are doing? They're not putting their money under the mattress. The Koch family now arguably has or soon will have more political power than either the Democratic or Republican parties. We believe that they will spend more money in this election cycle than either the Democratic or Republican parties. And for them, and for the Republican leadership in this country right now, and they're pretty open about it, Citizens United, which allows billionaires to spend as much as they want on the political process through independent expenditures, Citizens United did not go far enough. They want to now eliminate all campaign finance limitations. You know what that means? It means that one family will sit in a room like this and it will say to you, you want to run for governor of California? Here's a check for $300 million. There is your speechwriter. There is your media consultant. There is your campaign manager. Here is your check. And we're going to be watching you because you work for me. No more independent expenditures. You are on my payroll. And if we don't get our act together with campaign finance reform, if we don't overturn Citizens United, if we don't pass a disclosure law, if we don't move to public funding of elections, a handful of billionaires will, in fact, own the United States Congress and the democracy that this country so much touted and so much loved will be gone forever. So this issue of campaign finance is just a huge issue. Let me conclude very simply by letting you know the opposition that we are up against, what these guys stand for. and what is happening in the Congress. And the recent budget, I'm the ranking member of the Budget Committee, as David mentioned, this is what we're dealing with. You know what the Koch brothers stand for? Does anyone know? It's not just that they have a lot of money. This is what they stand for. In 1980, David Koch ran for Vice President of the United States. I want to read you a few of the planks of the Libertarian Party platform that he ran on. And these ideas, which 35 years ago were thought to be crazy, are now part of mainstream America. We favor the abolition of Medicare and Medicaid programs, not cutting, the abolition. In this budget, Republicans didn't abolish Medicare and Medicaid, but over the years they've tried to make Medicare into a voucher program, massive cuts in Medicaid. We propose the abolition of the government postal service. We oppose all personal and corporate income taxation. We support repeal of all laws which impede the ability of any person to find employment, such as minimum wage laws, i.e., we do away with the minimum wage and people in this country can work for $3 or $4 an hour. Quote, we oppose all government welfare, relief projects, and aid to the poor programs. All these government programs are privacy invading, paternalistic, demeaning, and inefficient. The proper source of help for such persons is the voluntary efforts of private groups and individuals. Now, you know what that means in English? That means the ending of every piece of legislation passed since the 1930s designed to help working people, the elderly, the children, the sick, and the poor. Goodbye, food stamps. Goodbye, Head Start. Goodbye, the Environmental Protection Agency. Goodbye, child care legislation. Goodbye, women's rights. Goodbye, anything, any piece of legislation. They want to take us back into the 1920s. Now, they haven't gotten there yet. But I will tell you that if you look at the Republican budget, a budget that was just passed last week, you know what that budget did? It repealed the Affordable Care Act and cut Medicaid by $440 billion. You know what that means? Let me tell you, because you didn't see it in the newspapers of America. It means that 27 million people were thrown off of health care if that budget was to be implemented into law, which it won't. But that is what they want. It means, at a time when families can't afford to send their kids to college, $90 billion in mandatory Pell funding cut. It means, at a time when families in this city and in Vermont struggling to feed their families, massive cuts in food stamps and nutrition programs. And by the way, it also provides huge tax breaks for the richest people in this country. And $38 billion more for the military off budget to be added to the deficit. That's where we are today. Now, what we have got to put in opposition to this is an agenda that represents the needs of the working people. And I think David and I can discuss that in a moment. But let me conclude by saying this. We need in this country a political revolution. And that means that every person in this room, every person in this state, every person in my state, all across this country, people have got to stand up and understand what is happening in our country. If we do not become more actively involved in the political process, if, as in the last election, 80% of young people did not vote, if that continues, I guarantee you, this country and the political system will be completely owned by the billionaire class. And what a tragedy that would be. So we have got to educate, we have got to organize, we have got to bring people together, and we have got to fight back, not just for ourselves, but for our kids and our grandchildren. I have 7 beautiful grandchildren, and I will be damned if they are not going to be able to live in a country that we are proud of. So thank you all very much for being here. Thank you.
I don't know that anyone can follow that, but in the meantime, they're going to put the senator's mic on. I just want to make a very brief announcement for those who are watching, listening. This is the Commonwealth Club of California. It's a program where we are having an amazing conversation, hearing from Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. I'm David Campos. I'm a member of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, and I'm moderating the program today. You can hear the Commonwealth Club on the radio. You can also find it on Facebook, Twitter. So with that, now I know that there are many questions, and we have a number of questions that have been presented by the audience. But as I hear your inspiring speech, the first question that came to mind is actually a question that someone asked from the audience is, what do you think it would actually make Congress more effective? What's the one thing that you think we can do to actually change Congress?
Good question. And the answer is not what people think. You know, people think, oh my God, what about, why can't people in Congress get along? And that ain't the issue. The issue is right now, virtually every major piece of legislation coming before Congress is sponsored by corporate America or the wealthiest people in this country. The American people want to raise the minimum wage to a living wage. That bill will not get to the floor under the Republicans. The American people think the rich should be paying more in taxes. What will get to the floor from the Republican Congress are more tax breaks for billionaires. The American people think we should make college education more affordable. What we get from the Republicans are major cuts in Pell Grants. So to answer your question, the issue is not what can happen in Washington. The issue is what happens in grassroots America. If you want change in this country, ordinary people from Maine to California are going to have to stand up in a way they never have before and tell the United States Congress, you know what? We got a lot of problems in this country. You're going to have to start listening to the working families and the middle class and not just your billionaire campaign contributors. And that is the way you change Congress.
Well, so how do you do that, Senator, when you're faced with the horrific decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in Citizens United? What's the solution in light of that?
Look, this stuff is not easy. You know, we should be proud as Americans that over the last 30, 40 years, we have made progress in a number of areas. I think 20 or 30 years ago, we would not have expected that an African American would be elected president of the United States or reelected, and that happened. That's something that we should be very proud of. The role of women in society has radically changed. Do we have to go a lot further in the fight for women's rights? Of course, but we have made significant changes. Gay rights, my God, has the world changed in the last 10 or 15 years. But this issue, David, of economic inequality, of taking on the billionaire class, of dealing with Citizens United, this is tough stuff. It is very tough stuff. These guys got it all, and they want more and more, and they don't care about what happens to other people. The only way that I know is to do what great people have done in struggles throughout our history, and that is to educate, to organize, to bring people together. What we have got to say short term is that we need a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. Citizens United, in my view, will go down in history as one of the very worst Supreme Court decisions ever. Second of all, short term, we can pass disclosure legislation, which says that if David Koch or other multi-billionaires wants to put ads on television, their pretty faces are going to have to be on their ads. And they're going to have to say, yeah, I approve this ugly, disgusting, lying 30-second ad. And you know what? They may hesitate to do that. And in my view, we have got to move toward public funding of elections.
I just read it again. I read it. I already read it. So Citizens United, I understand your response. What do you think it's likely to, what is the likelihood that something like that, a constitutional amendment, would actually pass? And if it doesn't pass Congress, then what's the solution?
Well, the short-term solution, which we did come reasonably close to passing, is disclosure. And I know you're working on something like that here in California, and that's great. And that could have an impact. But, I, you know, again, I think we have got to do our best to have public funding of elections until we overturn this disastrous decision.
So why should people in San Francisco, you know, San Francisco, by most accounts, is one of the wealthiest cities in the country, probably the wealthiest city in the country. Why should people in San Francisco care so much about this inequality?
Well, I'll tell you, you live here and I don't. And, you know, I visit every once in a while. But we were driving around, we're driving around the city today. And, yeah, I suppose this is a wealthy city, but if you see the people out on the streets, you don't get quite the feeling that it's all that wealthy. You know, but it's not just San Francisco. The United States is right now, in terms of total wealth, the wealthiest nation in the history of the world, and we are wealthier today than we have ever been before. But the problem is that when the top one-tenth of 1% owns more of that wealth than the bottom 90%, for the vast majority of the people, they're not seeing that wealth, quite the contrary. They're seeing a decline in their standard of living. And that is why, at the end of the day, if we are serious about transforming America, we have got to address this issue of wealth and income inequality. We have got to demand that the richest people in this country and the largest corporations start paying their fair share of taxes. We can no longer sustain a situation where we're losing $100 billion a year because corporate America is stashing their profits in the Cayman Islands and other tax havens. So we have got to be bold, and that is what the fight is about. Does America belong to all of us, or does it just belong to a handful of very, very wealthy people?
As an immigrant, my experience has been that education is the great equalizer. And in terms of addressing long-term this inequality, making education accessible to more people is the key. Do you think that your idea of free tuition for public institutions, does that have a chance in Congress?
The answer is yes and no. Left alone, it will just be a bill with a few co-sponsors. But if we can, and we're going to try to do that, we can galvanize young people on campuses all over this country to stand up, and I just spoke to a rally of wonderful young students in Washington last week. If we can mobilize young people to say, stop spending the money on the military, start spending the money on higher education, yes, we can win that fight.
So, I know that we have a number of questions that I want to get to. So one of the folks in the audience says, wants to know, how can we speed the transition to a renewable energy economy and, of course, reduce our carbon emissions?
Excellent and very important question. It goes without saying, as perhaps the most progressive member of the Senate, that I have serious disagreements with my Republican colleagues. Fair enough. That's an understatement. But there is a point which goes beyond differing opinions and at a point where some of my Republican friends become an international embarrassment. And that is on this issue of climate change. The scientific, you know, we can debate how much we spend on education and healthcare and all this stuff. But when you have virtually the entire scientific community telling us climate change is real, climate change is caused by carbon emissions from human activity, climate change is already causing devastating problems in this country around the world, and they are saying if we do not get our act together, this planet could be between 5 and 10 degrees Fahrenheit warmer by the end of this century. Can you imagine what that means? And yet we have the vast majority of Republicans in Congress, not all, the vast majority denying that basic scientific reality. And that is scary stuff, because it's hard to go forward in public policy if you have a majority party rejecting science. Now, in terms of what we do, we know what to do, and the options will only get better in years to come. In Vermont, we have pumped a lot of money into weatherizing homes. I have been in homes which have reduced their fuel consumption by 50%, saving money on their fuel bills, cutting carbon emissions. We should be doing that all over America. We should create the best rail system in the world to take cars and trucks off of the road. We should be investing heavily in solar, wind, geothermal, and other technologies. And by the way, when you do that, when you transform our energy system away from fossil fuel, you not only substantially cut carbon emissions, you create millions of jobs over a period of a year. We know how to do that, and that's what we should be doing.
So I know that there are actually a number of cars that are asking this question, Senator, and so let me just come out and ask it. Are you running for president?
Funny you asked that question. All right, let me be very, very honest with you. And this is just between you and me. Ignore
Don't
the
say
cameras
anything.
There, ignore the radio, all that stuff.
Don't say anything, please.
Don't say anything. Look, anyone who wakes up in the morning and has this passionate desire to become president of the United States is somebody you should never vote for because that person is totally crazy. I am amazed. Every now and then I meet with the president. I am amazed that he is still sane. And he is. I mean, it is just an unbelievably difficult job. And, you know, but this is what I do believe. I've just described, and I gave you the short version of the speech. This country faces huge problems. You know, we talked about climate change. We talked about income and wealth inequality. We talked about the fact that we're the only country in the world, a major country without national health care. We talked about college unaffordability, all of these things. And I believe that the middle class and working families of this country want and demand changes, fundamental changes, in what's going on. They are furious that they are working longer hours for lower wages, and the people on top are getting 99% of all new income generated. So obviously, it's no great secret, I am giving thought to the president. But let me tell you, you know, what my hesitancy are, and I'll be very, very honest with you, is, and this is not an ego thing, you know, like every senator, I have a huge ego, that goes without saying. But the questions that I have to ask, if you take on the Koch brothers, and if you take on Wall Street and call for the breaking up of the largest financial institutions in this country, and if you take on the healthcare insurance industry, and if you take on the pharmaceutical industry that charges us the highest prices in the world for medicine, and if you take on the military-industrial complex and say to them maybe they should not be selling weapon systems to the military with huge cost overruns, you know, if you take on those people, you're going to have a little bit of pushback. Could be wrong.
Just a little bit.
Just probably a little bit. And the issue is not that I can't articulate, I think, a vision that speaks for the majority of the American people, but in the real world of politics today, can we, in fact, and I don't know the answer, and I'd love you tell me, and just don't tell me the first thought that pops to your head. This is tough stuff. Can we put together a grassroots movement of millions of people who are prepared to tell the billionaire class that enough is enough?
Yes.
All right. You know, yesterday I was in Los Angeles, and it was unbelievable. We had 500-600 people coming out of a meeting that a group organized. Then we had another meeting with 500. I know there's a lot of support out there, but it doesn't make any sense to run unless we can do it well. Can we raise the hundreds of millions of dollars you need to run a credible campaign? In my last election, running for the U.S. Senate in Vermont, do you know what my average contribution was? $45. Jeb Bush apparently recently told his campaign contributors he was insistent he didn't want more than $1 million because it was getting embarrassing. All right? My average campaign contribution is somewhere around $45. I get more low-income contributions. I mean, we just sent out a fundraiser yesterday. I'm looking at the notes that are coming in. Dear Bernie, I'm on Social Security. I could only contribute $20 now. I'll try, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Disabled vet, da-da-da-da. You know? So here's the point. If one runs, it's not my ego that's at stake. It is the banner that I will be carrying for millions of Americans, people who are fighting for national health care for all of the issues we've talked about. If we do it, it has to be done well. It has to be done well. Because if it's not done well, then people say, oh, income and wealth inequality, you didn't do very well in your campaign. Nobody believes in that. Mm. Health care for all Americans, oh, no, you were rejected. So it's not my ego. It is a question of putting together that campaign. And that is what I'm trying to ascertain right now, whether or not we can put together millions of people who are prepared to work really hard to take on the big money interest.
Now, following up on that, the folks in this room, what can they do to make sure that they can share their thoughts about whether or not such a campaign
well,
can
be put
together?
Let me do it right now. Let me, you know, I do things in an unconventional way. I want honest opinions. Let me just throw it open to you. Is that all right, David?
Yeah.
I know what producers are going a little upset here, but I want an honest opinion. Don't tell me what I want to hear, what you want to hear. Can we, in fact, are people so demoralized? Have people so given up? Are people of the belief that you really cannot defeat these guys because they're so powerful? Or, in fact, is there enough hope left in America to bring our people together to fight for a different country? No, that was a question, not a comment. Ma'am, what do you think? Stand up, please.
Stand up.
Yes.
And elected against tremendous odds.
And I had the pleasure of visiting Richmond and speaking to 500 people there who defeated Chevron. You're right. They did it in Richmond.
How about the gentleman over there?
Sir.
Yeah, and 05 who stood up with Jerry McNerney and Pete Pombo. The whole Congress changed. That wasn't why we did it. We did it to just
Do you think, I'm not just talking about one congressional district. Do you feel in America there is that spirit, that willingness to stand up and fight back?
What I learned is that the only time to begin and push a movement like that is before it's obvious. Once it's obvious, it's already happened, this movement. Well, in order to be there, you have to be in well in advance.
Right. So the producers are telling me that for the radio show that we have a number of listeners, this doesn't work very well. But, you know, this is why we love Bernie Sanders, right? He's unconventional. So I guess I have one of the most important questions, and every question is important, but I was really touched by a question that someone in the audience asked, and that's a 16-year-old who is interested in becoming politically involved. Any advice for a 16-year-old?
Absolutely. You know, one of the many serious problems that we're facing, what the right wing is trying to do is make politics into a dirty word. Politics is not a dirty word. In a democracy, that's what people fought and died for. For serious debate, we respect people who disagree with us, but we want our young people to be involved in public service and in political life. We want bright young people, regardless of their point of view, to stand up and say, this is what I believe in, I'm thinking of running for office, I'm going to work on somebody's campaign. That's what democracy is supposed to be about. And what bothers me very, very much, and it is not an accident, is every day the attacks, politics is all crooked, everybody is an idiot, they're all crooks. Why? And by the way, if you get involved in politics, you can expect horrendous, ugly 30-second ads attacking you and your family. So the people are standing and say, why in God's name would I want to do this? Why would I want to do this? And I hope, and I say to that 16-year-old, you do it. You do that. You go out and go into your own heart and decide what you think is important, what you are prepared to fight for, work with your friends, and get involved and try to make this country a better place.
Thank you. Well, I'm sure that this 6-year-old will remember that this is advice coming from perhaps the future president of the United States. Something that is actually an issue that we in San Francisco, and I'm a gay man, and many members of the LGBTQ community have been very upset by what happened in Indiana. You have any thoughts on that?
You know, and I speak as someone who comes from a state, and I know California and San Francisco have been very, very strong for so many years on this issue, but my state was the first state in the country to pass civil unions. You may remember that. And here is some really good news, because I remember this. I was very much involved in it, saw it. It was a very painful process, and there was a lot of hate being thrown around my beautiful state. But what's happened over the last 10 or 15 years, when people see gay people and they see gay marriage, that hatred has significantly dissolved. The governor of Indiana is absolutely on the wrong side of history, and they know it. I go to schools all over Vermont, and this is the truth. I go to conservative parts of my state, and I say to the kids, you know, I ask them, what do you think about abortion? What do you think about this? I say, what do you think about gay marriage? And literally the kids shrug their shoulders, and they say, what are you talking about? What's the issue? It's not an issue. Their grandparents don't agree with them. But for the younger generation, and you have seen, by the way, 5-8 years ago, what was the Republican Party campaigning on? Homophobia, right? Vote against that person. He supports gay marriage. They don't talk about it anymore, or significantly less. The governor of Indiana may be the exception. But the Republicans are learning that that is no longer a good issue. So I think that his legislation that he is supporting, I doubt will be sustained over the years. America has moved in a very bold way to be a much less discriminatory society, and this guy is dead wrong.
I know that in San Francisco, in fact, I think there's something at the Board of Supervisors, there's talk of maybe boycotting or, you know, any thoughts on that?
Well, I think that the business community of Indiana, I guess they're hosting the NCAA now, is that right?
That's right.
And, you know, it's a lot of money coming into that state. And I think you will see, as we did see in Arizona. Remember in Arizona on an issue?
That's right.
I think when the business community and people say, excuse me, we are not going to go to your state, I think these guys may be rethinking their decision. And I certainly support that effort.
So we're going to continue with some of these questions. And someone asked, why don't we try to moderate CEO salaries? Any ideas on how we can do that?
Yes. Matter of fact, I do. You know, when you talk about the greed in the corporate world, there was a time 30, 40 years ago, you know, the CEOs by definition, the owners of companies always made more. There's nothing new about that. But it was within a reasonable differential. Today, the average CEO makes about 270 times more than the worker in the middle of the company. 270 times more. I think that that is dead wrong. And I think one of the ways you deal with that is you say that if CEO salaries are above a higher percentage than compared to the average worker, it is not tax deductible. So they're going to pay taxes on that.
I'm sure that that would get their attention. Another question related to the budget, and I know as an elected official, the budget is the most important policy document that you can pass. It shows what your priorities are.
Exactly.
Any idea of when and how the people's treasury will be used to benefit the middle class?
Well, the people's
treasury, the people's budget will be used to benefit the middle class.
Well, I mean, that requires a political revolution. What a serious budget would do is look at the problems facing America. What would they say? Okay, we're going to invest in rebuilding our infrastructure and create millions of jobs. How do we get the money? Well, we are going to say to the billionaire class and large corporations, you're going to have to start paying your fair share of taxes. A serious budget would say that we invest in our young people, childcare, and making college affordable. And one way that we raise the money to do that is not end up spending more money on the military than the next 10 countries combined. Mm-hmm. And by the way, maybe not getting into another war in the Middle East. Yeah. The point of all of this is if we were a poor country, you know, we would say, well, we'd like to, we just can't afford to do health care for all. You know, we're a poor country, we can't afford to make sure that college tuition is tuition free. We're a poor country, we just can't rebuild our crumbling infrastructure. We are not a poor country. We are the richest country in the history of the world. The problem is the distribution of wealth and income. Deal with that. You will have a budget that works for working families in this country.
I know that something that has been talked about a lot and wondering sort of where you see things headed is the power of Wall Street, banks, and these financial institutions.
Ah. My good friends on Wall Street. Okay. Now, and here's where you see, fundamental problems with our American political system. In the 1990s, it turns out when I was in the House, I was a member of what's called the House Financial Committee. So we dealt with these issues. And Republicans and Democrats and President Clinton, and I like President Clinton, but agreed that what we needed to do is deregulate Wall Street. And I remember, like it was yesterday, Alan Greenspan coming before our committee and saying all of the great benefits that would occur if we got rid of Glass-Steagall, and if we just allowed huge insurance companies to merge with huge financial institutions, to merge with huge commercial banks, what a wonderful world it would be. And it's actually up on YouTube, and I said, Alan, do you really think so? Do you really think that it will be a good thing when these people have so much concentration of ownership? Needless to say, as a result of their greed and their recklessness and their illegal behavior, they help destroy our economy. Now, what do? We have the largest six financial institutions today have assets of about $10 trillion. That is 60% equivalent to 60% of the GDP of the United States of America. These six financial institutions issue half of the mortgages in America and two-thirds of the credit cards in America. Now, if Teddy Roosevelt, a good Republican, were alive today, what would he say? He'd say, break them up. They're too big. That is my view. Break them up. Furthermore, if we want to raise revenue right now in order to make college affordable, we put a fee on Wall Street speculation, which could raise billions of dollars. Now, having said that, David, you think I'm going to get many campaign contributions from Wall Street?
Well, I think you're going to get a lot of $45 contributions, Trevor. So let's say that you know, once you analyze the situation, you decide to run for president, you get elected, but you still have you know, the kind of sort of political representation with Republicans in Congress. Someone wants to know what would you do? How would you, as president,
David? That is a fantastic question. So let me be very honest about that question. I happen to like Barack Obama. I've known him for many years. I like him and I respect him. He and I have disagreed on many issues. Some of you may remember I was on the floor 8.5 hours in a filibuster in opposition to his agreement to continue tax breaks for the rich, and I disagree with him on the TPP. You know, over the years, we disagree on a number of issues, but I have a lot of respect for him as an incredibly smart guy and a disciplined guy and a man who has dealt with unbelievable obstructionism. But here is the major mistake that Barack Obama made. And I got bad news for all of you. Because the issue here, if I haven't given you enough bad news already, the issue is not just electing a serious president who is going to fight for the working families of this country and is going to take on the billionaire class. Let me be very honest, and this is what David's question is about. No president, not the smartest and best president imaginable, can take on Wall Street and could take on the lobbyists, and could take on the Koch brothers alone. The big mistake that Barack Obama made, in my view, is that after his brilliant, almost unprecedented 2008 campaign, when he did extraordinary things, bringing white working class people together, and African Americans, and Hispanics, and gays, and straights, and women, and put together the kind of coalition that we desperately need to maintain. When he went to Washington, because he's a nice guy and a trusting guy, he actually thought that he could negotiate with the Republicans. And he kind of left those people who supported him, who worked day and night for him, behind. So David's point is exactly right in terms of that question. No president can do it alone. So if you are going to work on a campaign, if I run for president, you're going to work on that campaign, here's the bad news. You're going to have to keep working the day after we win the election. Because on all of the issues, I mean, here is the very good news. On all of the issues, should we create millions of jobs? American people say yes. Should we raise the minimum wage? American people say yes. Should we do pay equity for women workers? American people say yes. Should we deal with climate change? American people say yes. Should we deal with so many of the problems, infrastructure? American people say yes. But the billionaire class says no. So how do we engage and defeat them? The only way it can be done is for a president to be in direct relationship with the people of this country, to make sure that if these guys are voting against legislation that is important to the people of America, they will pay a political price. Now, right now, and we've got to deal with media issues. Again, as ranking member of the Budget Committee, they just passed the most disastrous budget that I can imagine. Tax breaks for billionaires and cuts in programs for hungry kids. 27 million people thrown off of health care. How many Americans even know about it? Have you seen one article? Tell me the truth. Maybe I'm wrong. Have you seen an article which said they threw 27 million people off health insurance?
No.
Most of you have not. All right, some of you have. But how? The difficulty is we got to get the word out. Does how many people in America know what the Koch brothers actually stand for? Probably not many. So the point is that to be successful, and that's what a political revolution is about. It's not just electing somebody. That's enormously important. But is standing shoulder to shoulder with that person in the enormously difficult fight. Do you know what these guys would do to resist paying a nickel more in taxes? Do you know what they would do to resist investing in America rather than in China or Vietnam? They will fight like hell. We can beat them because there are a lot more of us than there are of them. But we can't beat them unless we are educated and organized and mobilized. So that's the answer to that question.
So one last question. I know we have a minute or two left. So when will you decide if you're going to run for president? And what do you want these San Franciscans who, this is every seat in this space is taken. What do you want these San Franciscans to know?
All right. I have laid out the pluses and minuses. How many of you think that I should run for president of the United States? And how many of you, and this is a serious question, don't raise your hand unless you're serious. Don't tell me what I want to hear. If we did this crazy thing and ran for president of the United States, how many of you would be prepared to work hard on that campaign? Okay. Well, let me, we're coming to the end here. First of all, let me thank you all for being here. Thank you for not giving in to despair, which is afflicting so many of our people, to having hope that we can create the kind of America that we want to see. And thank you for your personal support for me. I appreciate that very much. So, and let me again thank the Commonwealth Club for doing exactly what we should be doing all over America, allowing serious debate on serious issues. Thank you all very much.
Well,
David, thank you, David, very much.
Thank you. Well.